Okay.
I'm Deborah.
I'm Carol.
Marilyn.
I'm Tim.
Okay. So, Roland asked me to give a talk this week, which is sort of interesting. And I wanted to choose a topic that is sort of accessible if someone had never heard it before. On the other hand, if you have heard it before, something I can maybe say something a little bit fresh about. So what I'm going to talk about is the five skandhas, okay? And that's a part of the basic, classic, oldest teachings of Buddhism in the Theravadan tradition. The five skandhas, also called the five heaps, or five aggregates, and just like five groups of stuff, that is how we relate to our experiences and form our build up ourself from those experiences. Like, there's a fundamental question. Like, we always talk in the Shambhala teachings about basic goodness, and we, all of us have basic goodness and everything. And so the obvious question to me is, well, if that's true, if you believe that we're all basically good, which I do, why are we so messed up? You know, what's the problem? You know, like, how do we get to the point where our day-to-day experience is so confused and painful, you know? And the five skandhas are part of the answer to that. And without belaboring it, I'll just name them and then we'll go into them a bit. They are form, feeling, perception, formation, and consciousness. And they kind of go in order and they kind of go at the same time. Form is all the stuff out in the world, rocks and trees and cars and car alarms and you know, other people. All of our experiences are grounded in the realm of form, in the skanda of form. Okay, and then the second skanda comes in, which is the skanda of feeling. And this is feeling in the sense of having an emotional reaction to the form that is presented to you. You may feel attracted to the thing, the form. You may feel repelled by it, want to push it away. You may feel neutral, like you don't really care. It's just there. Okay. So starting from the form, you come to the feeling, the emotional reaction. And then you come to the third skanda, which is the skanda of perception. And all these names are a little bit arbitrary, a little bit weird, a little bit strange. What they mean by perception is bringing in your sort of all of your concepts that you built up over the years in your brain, in your mind, about that particular form. So this is where you kind of bring in language. Whereas the form and the feeling are kind of pre-verbal at the level of concept, at the level of the skanda of perception. All the words come in and all those associations of those words. And so you may have lots of memories and associations about that particular thing that is the form that you're engaging with right now. And then you come to the fourth skanda, the skanda of formation. And what they mean by that is sort of, if the form is the raw material, the feeling is the emotional response, perception is the conceptual response, the fourth one is your kind of intentional response, like what do you intend to do about it, which is related to your karma, your past experiences, and your aspirations for the future and all that kind of stuff. For many of us, we think, we don't really know, but we think that we have much the same forms, much the same feelings a lot of times. And to some extent, we have the same concepts, although that varies from person to person. But you really have quite individual formations associated with those concepts based on your past experience. Like maybe it's time for a quick example. The classic one is the seeing a snake. So the form in your visual field is a little squiggly thing over there. you don't have words for it yet. We're still at the level of form, just a little squiggly thing. And your instinctual feeling about that is aversion. That's scary. I'm afraid. And the concept comes in. That's a snake, and it could hurt me. And then the formation is all these things about how you feel about snakes and your past experience with snakes. So for me, I remember the time when I was a kid and a park ranger let me pet a snake, and it was actually kind of fun. It was nice. Whereas someone else may remember the time that their uncle was bitten by a snake and had to go to the hospital. It was like terrible. You know, so depending on your background, you'd have very different intentional formations around that same experience. And finally, the last one, of course, is consciousness, which is where you get to kind of make a response, sort of judge, in fact, the outcome of those four earlier skandhas and maybe make a correction to them. So in the snake example, you may, at the conscious level, realize that the whole thing has been a mistake, that what actually is a rope that somebody left lying on the floor there. And it's the whole thing has been sort of an error, and your consciousness corrects it. Or it may be that at your conscious level, you know that in the past you have always like screamed and run away whenever you see a snake, and people have been sort of telling you, that's really not necessary. I mean, it's not, they're not that dangerous. I mean, it's very unusual for a snake to actually hurt a human, and so you might bring your consciousness to bear on this and say, well, maybe this time I don't have to scream and run away. I could do something else. Like maybe just sit and watch it, see what happens. Okay. So all of that is the basic pass over the five skandhas. But what I want to talk about now is a couple of ways in which I think a lot of people get it a little bit wrong, get it a little bit confused. Not that I have it perfect, but there are certain mistakes that I've made. One is, when we think of the forms and everything that follows from it, those are basically sensory experiences. It's what in Western philosophy would be called phenomenology, all the study of phenomena as they appear to you. And in the West, we think of phenomena in terms of five senses, sight, sound, touch, taste, and feeling. And it's very important that in the Buddhist tradition, there are six, and the sixth one is really interesting. That's, of course, the sense of your mind. And just like you have sights appearing to your vision, you have thoughts appearing in your mind. And in fact, the word that they use for it is dharma. That's one of the meanings of the word dharma. It doesn't have to be like a fancy Buddhist teaching. A dharma could be something as just a thought that, oh yeah, I have to remember to pay that bill next week. That's a dharma, and so it's actually interesting. And just like you don't have any choice about what forms appear to your vision, that's not within your control. In the same sense, you don't have control over what thoughts appear, what dharmas appear to your mind either. That also is not within your control. So that's really interesting to think about. And just as you have feelings about the things that you see, little squiggly things, you have feelings about the thoughts that arise. And that thought is a attractive thought. That thought is repulsive. That thought is neutral. So that the skandha of feeling applies equally well to thoughts as to anything else. And certainly concepts, when a thought arises, it drags in a lot of concepts about that thought and formations about that thought. And finally, consciousness of the thought, where the kind of thing you're getting into here is you certainly know if you've done meditation practice, you know that you have the same thought coming up again and again over the course of your meditation practice. For weeks at a time, you might have the same thought coming up. And your feelings and conceptions and formations and consciousness about that thought change over time. And so You may originally think, when that thought comes, oh, there's that thought. It proves that I'm a bad person. And if other people knew that I was having that thought, they would hate me, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then later you relax a little bit and you say, well, you know, yeah, that's a neurotic thought. It's kind of unattractive. But, you know, in the scheme of things, I mean, maybe I could give myself a little space around that and hope that it, you know, subsides. Or whatever. Or it may be that you form a formal intention to work with that thought and say, when that thought arises, I resolve to take a particular action, such as maybe, I don't know what, doing a little bit of Tung Len for myself or something. Anything. There's just any number of possibilities. Okay? So that was the one thing I wanted to say. So the first part of the talk was just the five skandhas, you know, the basic idea. The second piece was pointing out that sixth sense, the sense of thought, as being one of your experiences that comes to you. And then the third thing I want to talk about is, I mentioned phenomenology and all that, and it's easy to take the five skandhas just as a Buddhist phenomenology. And it's sort of like a theory of how our experience works. And the thing that's missing from that is that the skandhas are fundamentally a delusion. They're a way that we get it wrong. Okay? So it's not like this is how we relate to the world. It's like how we deludedly relate to the world. That's what the skandhas are about. And now that's interesting to think about, because does that mean that if you were a Buddha, you would not have the skandhas? And that's where the phenomenological view of it breaks down, because it doesn't mean, surely it doesn't mean that the Buddha would not see things and not have emotional reactions and not have concepts and not have intentions and not have conscious thoughts. I mean, that would just mean that the Buddha is sort of like basically dead, you know, I mean, that can't be. Right. I mean, of course not. And people, if you've had the privilege of being with any people with, you know, that are fairly engaged with enlightened experience, you see that they are filled with intentions and compassion and consciousness, you know, rich consciousness. And they have a lot of concepts. And, you know, it's all very rich. So the skandhas are not just phenomenology. They are kind of misguided phenomenology, and that's what's important to kind of stay with. And what does this mean? This is where this ego that Buddhists disapprove of is built up from. It's largely from the skandhas. And how can that be? You know, we start out from a pure field of basic goodness. Probably imagine like when you're a baby and you don't know anything yet. And what is your experience like at that moment? It's basically overwhelming. The world is infinitely rich, infinitely complex, infinitely overwhelming and kind of confusing. And you want to find a place of safety in the face of this overwhelming experience. And I think that's the germ, that's the genesis of this idea of self. Because the very first thing you do is to say, well, okay, I can sort of make a distinction between the things in my experience that are me and the things that I'm in experience that are not me, that are out in the world. And you sort of make this distinction between self and other. And then as each new experience comes in, you have to kind of work to shore that up. And one way to do that is to have feelings about it, say, yeah, this is great, this is attractive, or that's bad, that's something I want to push away. It's a way of shoring up this theory of self that you're assembling. And you bring onto it, as you get older and you're no longer a baby, you learn all these words and concepts and everything. And you learn from all the people around you the conventional understanding of, the conventional conceptual understanding of how the world is and how life is, you know, and it's like, well, you know, good girls don't do that, and, you know, all these things are taught to you, and I'm not knocking it. I mean, that is the way to get to a point where you can relate to the world with some limited success. It just, it comes at too great a cost, and by the time you get up into adulthood, it has outlived its usefulness, and that's when you just start to get into neurosis and all the other, you know, suffering and baggage that we do, you know, later in life, where it's sort of, we've taken it too far, and that theory of self, which served us as children, is now, I think, come to the end of its road, and it's more of a problem than a help at this point. Okay. And so we meditate as a way of getting some perspective on all this stuff and seeing, getting a little view into the, it almost comes in reverse order, almost backwards, that you first recognize the arbitrariness of your consciousness, and then maybe you get some leverage into the arbitrariness and unreality, and the Buddhist word is emptiness, of your mental formations, your karmic formations, all that stuff. You see that that isn't actually, you know, that thought does not mean that you're a bad person. You know, that isn't really right. And you get down, and you get some sense of the arbitrariness of concepts, and then feelings, and even ultimately the arbitrariness and emptiness of forms. Like, just think of like any of your friends. Every time you see your friend, they look a little bit different than they did yesterday. Maybe their clothes are different. Maybe they're tired today. They weren't so tired yesterday. All those forms shift. Your feelings shift. Your concepts shift. Your formations, your shift, and for sure your consciousness shifts. And you kind of get this I think is a little bit of what, like in the Heart Sutra, they're talking about the five skandhas very specifically as being empty of inherent reality. And that goes, you know, form is emptiness. Emptiness also is form, which is a very interesting idea too. Let me come back to that in just a moment. It's going to the five skandhas. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness is no other than form. In the same way, feeling, perception, formation, and consciousness are emptiness. The Shariputra, all dharmas are emptiness. This is from the Heart Sutra. And what he's saying is that, what I've been talking about, that if you really drill down into any of these skandhas, you find yourself in a situation of emptiness. Like, where is yourself in any of this stuff? Is it in your consciousness? Well, no, not really. Is it in your mental formations that you assembled? No. Is it in the concepts? Is it in the feelings? Is it even in the forms? And in all those places, nowhere can you really find yourself. Okay? Yeah. So that's what's going on here. The business about form is emptiness, emptiness also is form. We have a tendency as human beings to grasp onto things to get a position of safety. And so it would be really easier if you could just say, okay, I got it, everything is empty, you know, I'm done, life is good. But the thing is, emptiness, like nailing it down and saying that's empty, that's just another example of a form.
Okay? And a concept.
Yes, yes. And so it's not that simple. You know, emptiness is a form. You know, it's like, oh no. You know? And so that's what this is all about. And what I want to do now is a little quick exercise and then stop and we can discuss it. Okay? But I want to do this, an experiential exercise that might be interesting. So what I want you to do is become present in this moment and just kind of bring to your attention what's going on with you right now, which is in the context of these skandhas, you know, what forms are you aware of? What are you feeling about them? What concepts are present in your mind? What intentions, if any, do you have? And kind of like, how is your consciousness going? So just be there. Okay. That's the first part of three. The second part of this is, while kind of holding on to that, close your eyes. Stay with that particular experience that you were having a moment ago. It's already a little bit in the past, but just kind of be aware of how that was. And now for the third part, I am going to make a change in the environment. So keep your eyes closed and give me a moment to make a change. And now open your eyes. And wow! And in the terms of the skandhas, wow, what has just happened? The forms are more or less as they were, although now the way they're appearing to you is more intense, and the colors have changed and things like that. You may find, very possibly find, that your feeling is different, like you might have been comfortable before and feeling kind of uncomfortable now, or whatever, I don't know. And you might find a different set of concepts and formations and consciousness in this slightly changed environment. I didn't change very much. So that's it. I am going to now turn those lights off again because I don't like them. But I welcome any thoughts or discussion or questions or anything. Okay. Yeah.
So emptiness is the screen in which all of the skandhas are sort of playing themselves out.
Uh-huh.
And my experience is that that screen is the witness that, you know, if I meditate, it's almost like there is a place that I identify, and maybe no, emptiness has no identity. Okay, so if there's an identity there, then it's not emptiness, it's a concept. Okay, so there's something behind the concept that is just without a concept or without an identity, which is space, emptiness, that's observing even me thinking about itself. And so I was sort of seeing this screen that is, and also an observer, but then I think, okay, so that's a concept, so what's watching the observer? Where is the space or the emptiness that is just reflecting and that has no, that's formless and concept? Without concept, it's there. It's tangible, but it's not a skanda because it's the same. It's the same as it was when I was a baby. Because I remember, I had this memory of being in my pram. We call them prams, and there was the same experience. I think, oh, that's who I am, because I was having other thoughts then, like where's my bottle and where's my mom.
Yeah.
But now there's a quality that's the same. Even all these years later, that I think, oh yeah, that's the same. It was the same then, it's the same now. And it seems like it hasn't ever changed. Yeah. Everything else has changed. But that's never changed. And I wonder if that's the emptiness. Mm-hmm. I wonder. I mean...
I can't answer.
No, I know.
Of course not. It's like, part of this is like looking into a pair of mirrors and you get this kind of mutual reflection back and forth.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, it just sort of explodes into kind of nothingness because it's no... There's no end.
There's no end.
To the going back and forth about is it this or is it that? You know?
Yeah. But those are all thoughts, but there's something that sees the thinking. That I'm glad that I've experienced.
Well, there is the, like, I don't know, we don't quite have a word for it. I mean, there is, normally when people talk about what I'm talking about, it's like they use the word consciousness. Like, I'm conscious of that experience.
Yeah.
But it's not consciousness in the sense of the fifth skandha. It's more like just I'm experiencing that.
Yes.
And in a pre-conscious or or some kind of way.
Yeah, before all the skandhas manifest in whatever form they're manifesting, there is a consciousness that is just there watching all of this happen.
Maybe that's what it's like to be a Buddha. You know, it's like to be just there,
well,
you know, in that experience.
I wouldn't claim to. No,
but I mean, you know,
there are glimpses that. Uh-huh. So what you're saying makes sense, and I see the phenomenology of it, the changing, you know, the shift, and that's always going on in this moment. That there's this change. There's the breeze and the fan and this. Even when nothing's changing, there's still a change.
Yes.
And
well, you are changing too every moment.
Yes. There's a heartbeat. There's a brain cell dying. in my
case. You know that expression, you can't step in the same river twice.
Yeah.
I like that.
Not even from one breath to the next.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I brought up a web page that had to do with, it was to do with consciousness, and I have it on my phone waiting to read, and it's all about the five skandhas. So this is perfect timing.
Great.
So thank you.
Well, I mean, part of the reason I chose this topic was I was realizing how I had it wrong, and that's why I kind of focused on those two ways about, you know, bringing in that sixth sense, the mental aspect. Is really important, and then to use the term loosely, deluded aspect of the skandhas.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those are important to kind of keep foreground when you're thinking about this stuff.
I have to go.
All right.
But
thank you.
I have to leave. I've got somewhere to be. Now, so.
Okay, great.
See you.
Nice to see you again.
Yes.
You too.
Nice
thanks
to
for coming.
See you all too.
Yeah. Oh, we'll take care of that. Don't worry about it.
A few years ago, Tsongi Rinpoche spoke at the Boulder Shambhala Center for a weekend. And he was talking about the skandhas, and the example he gave was, he said the skandhas can be manipulated or formed by you to make a self with a capital S.
Yeah.
And you may feel that this is real and that it's something that persists from moment to moment. But in fact, you've created it. Uh-huh. And because you've created it, it doesn't. It's not the same from moment to moment, but somehow, because you want it to be, you think that it is. And he gave the example of the Dalai Lama. He said, you know, when the Dalai Lama is meeting with the United Nations or speaking to 2,500 people or writing policy about how to deal with the Chinese in Tibet, then he is this presence in the world with the capital S. He plays that role. But then he goes back to his monastery where he gets up at 4 a.m. and meditates and runs on the treadmill for 2 hours and then meets people and then has ceremonies. And in all of those, and in that part of his life, he has a self in the sense that he has a social presence, I guess you'd say. Mm-hmm. But it's with a small s. And it's not anything that is important or impressive. Or for public display, it has none of that aspect. It's just a person doing what he does in his life. So it was helpful to me because I could certainly see how in my life I have created a presence, a self with a capital S, especially when I was a teacher. Mm-hmm. And to some extent in my family, you know, I'm the oldest child, that's my role. Mm-hmm. And I could see how I was letting go of that sense of self and just trying to pay attention to the moment and what was it that I was experiencing in the moment without having to worry about whether that self was doing it right or following what I thought should be my way or being consistent. I mean, it was kind of like forgetting about it, just releasing it.
I think it's really interesting that there are, that there's the problem of being a really good clown, you know, that, which is if you perfect yourself with a capital S, and you're on stage and people love you, and then you go off stage and you don't have any self with a small S, and you feel just lost. And there are many people, you know, people that have been loved by the public that have very painful private lives because they can't operate unless they're on stage. You know, and I think that's really interesting. I'm thinking of people like, say, Peter Sellers or Judy Garland or maybe Kurt Cobain or, you know, who knows?
Bill Clinton.
Yeah. Well, indeed, politicians are entertainers in a very profound sense.
They entertain themselves. Yes. Like when there's nobody to watch, you know, they realize that, oh, I'm just an entertainer. It's not sort of empty here.
Yeah.
It's a tough time.
Huh. LBJ for sure. Yeah. Anyway, that's it.
So going back to the skandhas, so I'm not clear about the difference between, and maybe it's not important, but I'm not clear about the difference between, okay, so we've got form, feeling, then concept, then what's the next one?
Formation,
and then. Okay, so I'm not clear about concept and formation, how they're different, if they are, if it matters.
Well, I mean, one thing is they're not, I don't think it's entirely sequential, like you do the first thing and then the second thing.
Yeah, it's all at one moment.
But
so it's kind of an analytical.
Yeah. What I was reading this week, you know, I was sort of reading up on this stuff, and it is that the difference between concept is sort of like neutral. It's like finding a bunch of relevant pieces of information from your file cabinet and setting them out on your desk. That's the concepts. And then formation is where you apply intention or bring in an agenda and say, in response to all these concepts, what I want to do is this with this stuff.
So it's more volitional.
Yeah. And it's tied very much to karma, for sure. Because what you choose to do is generally driven by your past experiences, you know.
It has something to do with action.
Yeah, yeah.
So kind of up to that point, or sort of the first three or a little less, based on your history or your karma, or a little bit based in the moment, or is that a fair...
Yeah, I mean, of course, which concepts you have also depends on your history.
Sure, yeah, and even though maybe the way we feel about things, certainly, and see things too, right? But thinking just, it seems like there is kind of a break there where you're starting to process or analyze things a little bit more consciously.
Yeah. Where I am a little blurry is between the fourth and the fifth. Like, what's the difference between your intentions and then applying consciousness to those intentions. That's a little tricky.
Well, you know, in that book, Buddha's Brain, he doesn't really talk about it from that standpoint, but he does bring up that process You know, first you have all of these things that happen in your brainstem and in your amygdala and the hippocampus, and then you have things that happen in the cortex and the temporal lobes, and it's all immediate, but the things that happen in those different parts of the brain have different effects.
Yeah, one way of looking at it, I've heard, is that at a gross level, the difference between animals and people is that people have the fifth skanda, and animals more or less have just four. You know, they do reach the level of intention, and their intention is, you know, to attack or run away or whatever. Whereas the cortex, the human prefrontal cortex stuff is having been through all that, then you have a chance to actually reflect on it critically and maybe change the decision you would otherwise have made.
And tell a story about it.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed your exercise. You know, it's interesting that it occurred to me that that whole delusional aspect of the skandhas is, you know, both in sort of a positive and can be in a negative way, in that a lot of times I've seen sort of just with the light changing, you know, things that seemed, you know, previously, you know, just kind of vanilla daytime light, you know, in the evening, suddenly things take on this very nice, charming, you know, light and things. And it's funny how just something as subtle as the lights can change it from soft to harsh, or harsh to soft. And it's based on, you know, very much our interpretation, or my interpretation anyway.
Yeah.
And those things can so easily be manipulated.
Yeah, completely.
That's what theater is all about.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Or is, I was thinking about a particular restaurant that we used to go to in New York, and they had the shades on the lights were peach colored. And we became friends with the owner of the restaurant. That was a deliberate choice, because peach colored light is the most flattering to, especially as people get older. And so it was one of the reasons why people wanted to go to his restaurant. Because that light was just made them feel. It was really interesting.
Well, I have that arouses a story for me, which is, you know, in Italian art, like from the Middle Ages and stuff, they have this beautiful golden light. And I thought that was an artistic convention, you know. And then I got the privilege of going to Italy, and they have that golden light. I think it's like olive dust in the air or something like that. You know, it really is a different, you know, it's like, wow.
Well, that's very true. I was thinking about when I moved from Colorado to the East Coast, I really noticed the difference in the quality of the light. Mm-hmm. Because if there's so much humidity in the air, it really changes it. Mm-hmm. And when I moved back from the East Coast to Colorado again, it was really shocking, because everything was so sharp-edged.
Mm-hmm. And some people don't like that. I mean, there are people who love the desert and people who don't. Mm-hmm. And I think the people who don't may be put off by the harshness of the light and everything in the desert.
And you don't realize it, really, I don't think, that that's what's making you feel a certain way. It's because that's...
No, I don't think you analyze it.
No.
It's just like, oh, I don't like this.
Yeah. And there's many thousands of subtle things, too. Yeah. You know, the light or the...
Smells.
Smells, the dust in the air, or the temperature, the humidity, or... Yeah, just very subtle.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because you could... If you could stop and analyze that a little bit, because I'm just thinking what you're saying. Oh, I'm hot and it's humid. And go, okay, what is that? Instead of, there's just a reaction. You don't really think about what it is that's actually happening in the environment. You just react.
Right.
But then if you're mindful, you stay with your reaction.
Yeah.
And try to feel what it is.
With no conclusion.
Yeah, just feel it.
It's hard not to to stay with something and not try to make a project out of it.
That's right.
Right, that's the thing to notice it. Let it go. That's the tough part.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the next minute, oh, shoot. It's gone.
Yeah. Well, I remember in one of Pema Chodron's books, I've forgotten which one, maybe it might be the one, Maybe Things Fall Apart, one of the first ones of hers I ever read. She talks about how important it is to, it's contradictory, but to be comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That you have to live on in this place where nothing really is right. Uh-huh. And that's the place where you begin to make progress.
Yeah. That's because when you run away, there is no progress. Mm-hmm. You just hide.
Stay in what you think is
effort. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Funny how the phenomenal world gives us so much stuff to work with. Unrequested things.
Endless stream.
The Dharma is true whether you want it to be or not.
Yeah.
That's
what's true. And you're trying to say, no, thank you. No, Ben.
That's a good point, Eric.
Okay, well, anyway, thank you all.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, any announcements or anything?
Is it, they had Rirma practice listed on the calendar tomorrow, is that true?
I believe it is not. I believe they canceled it for July.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure that's true.
Because I didn't see anything online about it.
Did you get email from Melissa relatively recently? Because she was looking for your email address.
Yes, I did.
Okay.
She lost me.
Okay.
And then found me again.
Okay. I could just say, if there's anybody who wants to try to organize a trip to the stupa in August, mm-hmm. there will not be a trip unless somebody volunteers to organize it. Mm-hmm. So if anybody's interested in doing that, mm-hmm. that would be great.
Yeah.
Okay. Does it have to be August? Is that the thinking?
No, it doesn't have to be, but in September we have Harvest of Peace, right? Harvest of Peace. And in October we have our hike.
Oh, okay.
And it's hot in August for our hike.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that was why, but it doesn't have to be then.
Okay, no, those are good. Yeah, I was just wondering that thinking.
There is the art walk coming up pretty soon.
Yes,
July 19th.
Yeah.
Next Saturday.
Next Saturday, right. 4 to 8.
That's 4 to 8. Yes, if anyone wants to help or anything, I'm coordinating, so just let me know.
What is that exactly?
It's Longmont has an art walk where the art galleries are open and there are booths and things on the street. And we go there as Longmont Shambhala Meditation Group and staff a booth. To just tell people about, you know, what we offer and tell people a little bit about meditation and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's for 4 hours, and we usually just try to talk to as many people as want to talk and come by the booth.
So some people are curious about what Shambhala is, and some people know what Shambhala is, but had no idea that it was here in Longmont. So both, you know.
Yeah, all of those pieces.
Yeah.
No, it's in Boulder.
What? No.
Yeah, a lot of people ask, how are you related to what goes on in Boulder and all those kind of things.
Oh, yeah. We're our stepchildren.
Right. We've broken away.
Right. Okay. Well, let's close with bow. Okay. I like that. Okay.
So is it the decision that